tell the bosses we're coming. A new action plan for workers in the 21st century with Sean Rickman, program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Junior School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College and author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming.
So I want to start with the reality that U.S. labor is in bad shape. Mm-hmm. Unions have long been on the decline, and I speak as a lawyer who is extraordinarily negative with the state of the courts, so state courts, but generally federal courts at this juncture. But nevertheless, there is a reality that the Supreme Court rules against labor regularly, as do the lower courts. So, Sean Rickman, in your new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, you telescope how unions are struck with decades of lousy court decisions, which we certainly agree on, and a playing field that is tilted against them that operates towards diminishing the power of these organizations of the working class. And yet, you look at the issue of labor law as a revitalization or permitting the revitalization of organized labor's organizations. Talk about your theories and your concerns there.
I'm trying to get us to look at this a little bit differently. I mean, the system is a trap. The legal labor relations framework is absolutely a trap, and unions have been on the decline for half a century, really, because the law smiles upon an employer who decides to secede from the system, who decides to subcontract a group of workers, to offshore them, to gigify their workers. Meanwhile, on the flip side, the only time that the National Labor Relations Board can go directly to the courts to get in enforcement action is when unions engage in solidarity activism. So, for example, when Nabisco decided to shut down an Oreo factory in the city of Chicago and ship those jobs overseas, the natural response would have been for every supermarket worker in America to say, I'm not going to ring up an Oreo cookie. I'm not going to put it on the shelf. I'm not going to unload that truck. And that would be illegal, and the NLRB has to go to court and get an injunction, and then the judge can apply triple damages to the union. And, of course, you know, whatever triple damages, whatever the employer claims. So Nabisco would claim $1 billion, and there's no union that has $1 billion, let alone $3 billion. So it's a grossly unfair system. But I am suggesting that there's a couple of different ways we have to look at this. The reality is that, look, American employers have been incredibly hostile to their workers and particularly to the organized expression of their workers forever. I mean, this is a country where they drop bombs on us. They machine gun us down. So we do actually need state power to back up what workers' rights are. But the framework of the National Labor Relations Act is broken. It's broken in a couple of respects. One, basing whether you have a union or not on whether there was some high-stakes election at your specific work site years ago, and whether you've been able to hold on to that, is a system that employers can secede from. A bigger sort of conceptual framework problem is that our rights as workers, and frankly, our civil rights. Civil rights law was patterned on labor law, and we're dealing with hostile courts who are overturning really common sense, you know, civil rights and labor rights laws. And so what wound up happening is our rights get pegged to Congress's authority to regulate interstate commerce. It's in the Commerce Clause. Our rights are not based in the First Amendment, in the 13th Amendment, in the Fifth Amendment, which is where I think they belong. It's based in commerce as this sort of compromise, but it's a very lousy compromise because employers go to the court and they argue that they have a First Amendment right. They have a First Amendment right to conduct captive audience meetings. They have a First Amendment right to, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into the Janus decision, which is just gobbledygook. I mean, the decision might as well have read, screw you, we have the votes. There was no logic to it. the weaponized First Amendment versus the Commerce Clause is where we lose. The Commerce Clause is no match for the weaponized First Amendment. So I do think that we need to have more sort of constitutional theories of what our rights are, both in terms of when we're drafting legislation. I think one of the biggest defects of the PRO Act is that it doesn't address this constitutional rooting of where labor law is, and so the judges will eviscerate it. But beyond that, one of the things that I'm trying to shine a light on, this is particularly with the Labor's Bill of Rights section, is that for too many unions, the lawyers have had the last word on organizing strategy. And look, lawyers are important. I think they should be in the room. I don't think they should be the default last word. Because the courts are so hostile, the strategy is essentially avoid the courts and try to operate within this very restrictive framework we've been in. Like, don't break the law intentionally, certainly, and don't intentionally go to court to argue our constitutional rights because the judges are going to be hostile, which totally, there's a lot of truth to that. But that's only a strategy for losing more slowly. And we need breakthrough strategies. And when you look at the full weight of our labor law regime, there are parts of it that are just sort of obviously unconstitutional. If you get out of Washington, D.C., if you take an NLRB certification election, the National Labor Relations Board, which is our main federal agency tasked with defending workers' rights, ostensibly. So this is an election that's going to determine whether additional statutory rights are going to be applied to the voters in the election. And it's an election that's conducted by an arm of the federal government. And the rules of the election are such that one party and one party only can force every voter to attend a mandatory meeting where they get to present their position or be fired. And within that meeting, they can lie, they can threaten your job. Crucially, they can hire somebody to impersonate a federal officer to lie about what your rights even are. And the other party has no right to respond at all. And beyond that, it's not just that the party is the boss, it's that it can only be a boss that advocates a no vote. If the boss were actually to hold a meeting and say, you know what, we think it's fine to have a union, that would also be illegal. When you step back from that and you look at it in those terms, how is that not a politically coerced speech? How is that not a massive First Amendment violation of every voter in that election?
Sean, we're talking about the law, and there are the Democrats in the House have proposed what you call the PRO Act, which would give additional rights to workers if that ever get passed, if the Senate in the next election turns, a bunch of ifs. But the last times that unions actually started to organize en masse, they had no rights. Back in the 1930s, they had no rights, and they were able to start a movement. They were able to do mass strikes. The last time that they were doing in the current period is in the 60s with public sector workers union, who had no unions, had no rights under the union.
Had no laws,
And they were able to also start a movement among public sector workers in the 60s, having no rights except maybe civil service rights or non-union rights. To what extent is the focus on, or should the focus on, changing the laws? And the other part is, how do we get a movement out of this labor movement?
So like I said, I want us to look at labor law from new angles. And there's one thing that we do on the left that I think is very, very disempowering for us, that we tell ourselves that we're only going to get legal changes if we can get a new wave of sit-down strikes, if we can start the general strike. And that's not entirely true. And so I feel like everybody's making analogies about 1932. This is, if we're lucky, we're in our century's equivalent of 1932. You know what I mean? Things would get a lot worse, too. What people forget is that the Roosevelt administration, first of all, Roosevelt comes into office, and I don't think anybody in this conversation would have voted for him. I think we would have had a different candidate. And I think that we all would have really not been a fan of his in his first 100 days in 1933, because he had a much more pro-corporate approach to dealing with the Great Depression. And his first signature labor law was the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was really meant to get companies to collude over prices. but it dealt unions in just because he didn't need extra noise. The law was already controversial enough, and weak as it was, AFL opposition could have synced it. So in addition to the colluding over prices, there was this notion of, well, employers should also collude over labor conditions, and there should be some sort of organized worker voice within that, and that could be anything. It turned out to be a lot of company unions. But beyond that, the law included this thing called Section 7A, which is the first time that the federal government guaranteed a worker's right to organize. And in fact, that's all it said, is that you have a right to organize. Was not worth the paper it was printed on, because there was no enforcement mechanism. So as steel workers were organizing in 1934, they were still getting machine gunned, because there was no enforcement mechanism for the law. What the law did, though, and this is interesting, what the law did, though, is it did just enough to raise the expectations of enough workers and then quickly dash their hopes that it actually sparked a strike wave in 1934. And remember, the National Labor Relations Act, our current main labor law, that's from 1935. So the National Labor Relations Act is passed in response to the fact that there's no enforcement mechanism to Section 7A, the fact that there is this strike wave going on, and then it only becomes constitutional because the Supreme Court is reacting to the sit-down strike wave of 1937. So I'm suggesting that there's a dialectic at play here, and it's not simply a matter of let's focus on getting the general strike, let's focus on getting the sit-down strikes, and then we'll think about what the labor law is. I'd rather be thinking about what the labor law is so that we're ready for that conversation, because, life moves at you fast. And if we don't have radical ideas about what labor law should look like, then we're going to get lousy laws. We're going to get more lousy laws. But also, particularly in the context of a Democratic candidate as underwhelming as Joe Biden is, we do need to think about, we might get something. And I think the PRO Act is lousy. I don't think the PRO Act would actually make a real difference for most workers. I think we need systems that are all in labor relations systems that go wider, that go sectoral, that go to your just cause rights of employment. But the dynamic could easily be raise our expectations, dash our hopes, and then we're going to really march on the bosses.
Again, some of my most negative experience flows from the law after 35 years of litigating in an arena that is, of course, not only highly politicized, but is generally there to preserve the status quo, and where we understand that right now the ascendancy, certainly in the federal arena, has been more than 200 judges that have been promoted to those venues by the Trump administration, etc. So, and employers love to have their grievances moved to the courts. And this happens with great regularity. So what I want to go back to is taking what I particularly loved about your book, which was actually the appendix, the Labor Bill of Rights, the free speech, the right to self-defense and mutual aid, i.e. solidarity strikes, the right to strike, freeing labor organizing from unreasonable search and seizure, the right to dues processing, the right to be locked out for not to be locked out for exercising labor rights, etc., various constitutional-based issues. And I still want to ask how, in some ways, it's not putting the cart before the horse until we have a militant, aggressive movement, until we have our Black Lives Matter percolating up from the grassroots in the street, how is it possible to get the Congress, how is it possible to get some statutes or to force the courts to use constitutional law when we are, as opposed to the Commerce Clause and so on, when we are so powerless and when the union bosses, if you will, have capitulated on so many of these issues. So it's like
a movement strategy. It's about the tactics of being able to get more from the courts.
So I want to plant a flag here and say that as much as we're talking about legal rights and as much as maybe 50% of my book is about legal rights and legal strategies, there's also a lot in the book that's about sort of activist strategies and things that are within unions' control. And I don't want to lose that thread because I'm not mm-hmm. saying we should be depending entirely upon the courts and upon politicians. I am saying, though, that it's important, and I do think that we on the left pay too little attention to it at our peril, because then we just leave it to the liberals and the centrists, and they screw it up. So we need to be engaged in those conversations. And I think also, you know, in the book I talk about strikes and how we got to get back to striking and how that's more easily said than done, because striking is contagious, which means workers need to see examples of other workers going on strike and winning in order for it to plant the notion that they can also go on strike. And, you know, and in the book I throw a lot of cold water on the idea that you know, I mean, 2019 was a great year for strikes. It was the high watermark in the 21st century so far. But all it did is it got us back to 1986 levels of strikes. And 1986 was a lousy year for strikes. And, of course, the problem there was that, you know, employers were effectively using strikes to union bust, daring their unions out on strike over draconian cuts in pay and benefits, and then importing a bunch of scabs and permanently replacing the strikers with those scabs and having the scabs vote to decertify the union. That was the playbook. And within those terms, striking became a terrifying prospect to most workers in this country. I think that's changing. I mean, I think it's important that 2019 was so far the high watermark of striking. I'm frustrated by how little we know about what's going on out there, partly because all the reporters are getting laid off. But we might actually be in a strike wave right now. You know, you hear anecdotally all these stories about, you know, Amazon fulfillment centers and McDonald's stores where the workers are going on strike over personal protective equipment. Because, you know, you can only push us so far. Workers, our backs are against the wall. Our pay sucks. Our lives are at stake, and I think workers are actually getting the notion that they need to go on strike. That said, I mean, you know, I can't wait till, you know, we've dealt more effectively with this pandemic and we can all get back to work, and then we can all turn around and immediately go on strike, because it is definitely going to take a strike wave. It is definitely going to take a strike wave to make real changes here. But again, I think the dynamic at play, the sort of the dialectic of raising expectations and dashing hopes is important. So I would say that the Labor Bill of Rights strategy is a little bit of that. You know, workers who are non-union workers who are going on strike, right? The Amazon fulfillment workers, the McDonald's workers, you know, they're not a part of a union for the most part. They're just going on strike, wildcatting over their jobs, their lives. I think that the argument's language about rights resonates with people. And so you make the argument, and then if the courts rule against you, I think that the moral outrage that can provoke is very helpful noise. I think that could actually spur on more protest activity. Let's argue that we have rights. Let's argue that we have a right to be free from involuntary servitude, that we have a right to due process, that we have a right to free assembly. You know, right? The First Amendment has, you know, three prongs to it, and we only talk about speech or religion. We never talk about assembly. What is a union if not an active expression of free assembly? What's a picket line if not an active expression of free assembly? We need to be making those arguments. But beyond that, again, you know, getting back to the NLRB elections, I mean, this was the Labor's Bill of Rights argument, essentially, that we've left behind a whole slew of protests, of legal challenges that we can make. Because we tend to give the courts a little bit too much power in our mind. We tend to think of labor laws only being a thing that can be legislated, and of course it's going to be filibustered. The ability of an employer to conduct a captive audience meeting in an NLRB election comes from, of course, a Supreme Court decision, and it comes from employers arguing, hey, we have a First Amendment right to express our opinion. That has mutated into, like, this bizarre version right now where, you know, the First Amendment rights of the other side are nowhere to be found. And this is the thing that drove me nuts. This is really what set me down a path. So for a time, the NLRB would enforce a kind of an equal, sort of an equal sides rule, that if an employer decided to use their right to do captive audience meetings, that it would trigger the union's ability to access the workers on the job site. And this ping-ponged back and forth depending on whether you had a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. And so in 1966, the labor movement was pushing for a return to sort of an equal time standard in NLRB election speech. And the NLRB said, this drives me nuts, the NLRB declined to reassert the equal protection, the equal time rule, because they said, look, earlier today we issued a different decision, Excelsior Underwear, that says that, you know, within X number of days of an election, the employer has to give you the names and the home address information of the voters. And we're asking you, try that and see if that, you know, see if that sort of equalizes things. If it doesn't, come back to us. 1966. If it doesn't, come back to us. Well, did we come back to them? What's your guess?
No.
We never did. We never did. So here's the NLRB on record as saying, look, come back and make this argument to us. If this doesn't, you know, and you know, I mean, I think it's partly because there wasn't as much union organizing happening between 1966 and, say, 1986. And unions are very much institutions on the staff side and on the leadership side that the education is a lot of word of mouth. You know, it's a lot of sort of stories by the campfire. So if you let two decades go by, things get forgotten. And that's a huge thing that got forgotten. And so the Labor Bill of Rights argument, what I'm trying to say is every time that an employer conducts a captive audience meeting, file an unfair labor practice and point to that 1966 decision and say, this is unfair, they're violating our rights. And any time that a union loses an NLRB election, file to have the results overturned because of those captive audience meetings. Do it even during a Trump NLRB. We're going to get overturned every time. Do it so you make it this active and obvious protest that the next Democratic NLRB knows they have to respond to. Why not? Why would you not make that argument at least? Win, lose, or draw, get people mad about it. Because they should be.
And finally, just in terms of creating a movement, I mean, there is a movement out there, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the unions have been very, very loath to join with that movement in any organized way, in any way that supports that movement and with that movement, although there are some exceptions. The SEIU, for example, is testing some ground in that. How do you think we should respond to the Black Lives Matter movement as the unions?
Well, I mean, I'm closer to the unions that are more responsive to Black Lives Matter. So I don't because of that, I guess I don't quite agree with your characterization of where unions are on Black Lives Matter. But I think that the next stage of Black Lives Matter has to be, how do we take these protests to the workplace? You know, we're out in the streets right now for obvious reasons, and we have to be. And we're making the arguments, on defunding the police because we have to be. But at the end of the day, I think the three of us agree that corporations have way more and way too much influence over official government policy, and therefore we have to make the corporations feel some pain here. And that means taking the protest to the job, you know, not just boycotts, but take it to the job. And so I'd like to see us find ways to facilitate getting Black Lives Matter leaders interfacing more with, say, bargaining for the common good leaders, and just strategizing more about what that looks like and how we expand the scope of solidarity on these issues.
Well, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century, is indeed that. And Sean Rickman, you have and are a critical voice in the fight for workers' rights in this gilded age, this new gilded age. And Tell the Bosses is a manifesto for real change to give workers power over their jobs, and that's agreed to and said by Eric Loomis, author of A History of America in 10 Strikes. And you must, if you care about your rights, about the rights of workers, about the rights of the working class, pick up A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Tell the Bosses We're Coming by Sean Rickman. Sean, thank you for the work that you do. The book is put out by Monthly Review Press and is a must read for the working class.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Sean Rickman, Program Director of the Harry Van Allersdale School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College, and author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash, and you've been listening to Building Bridges. Stay strong.
Amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo issued this executive order.
All people in public must have a mask or nose covering, mouth and nose covering, and they must wear it in a situation where you cannot or are not maintaining social distancing.
Governor Cuomo on continuing to stop the spread of the coronavirus, and WBAI to raise money for this listener-sponsored station to keep it going. We've created face masks with our own logo and a message that reads, "Keep Free Speech Radio Alive." You can get a face mask in white or black by donating $35. You become a listener sponsor, a member of WBAI for a full year, and you can choose the face mask in white or black. WBAI has created these face masks for you, and as a way to keep this radio station afloat, $35 contribution, 516-620-3602. Say you want a WBAI face mask in white or black. It has a saying that reads, "Keep Free Speech Radio Alive." You'd be helping us to keep WBAI and Free Speech Radio alive. 516-620-3602, or go to givetowbai.org and select the WBAI logo face mask in white or black. $35. You're a member of WBAI for a full year, and you're supporting this radio station. You're helping to keep our essential workers working, and you're helping WBAI pay the bills. We know how difficult it is, how hard it is for many people. If you can afford it, please become a member of WBAI for $35 a year and select the face mask as a gift to you.
WBAI's Progressive LGBTQI News, Culture, and Activist Hour this Tuesday, July 21st at 8 p.m. for attorney and professor Dean Spade's discussion of the limitations of the Supreme Court recent ruling on LGBT employment protections.
It's almost impossible to prove this kind of discrimination to meet the evidentiary standards.
Professor Spade compares the likely results to the results of the civil rights laws.
When these laws were passed aimed at eliminating the kinds of nonstop racism that have existed in U.S. Employment, they were kind of then eviscerated by courts.
Join Out FM this Tuesday, July 21st at 8 p.m. on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming at WBAI.org.